So tonight we'll talk about lithic technology, the manner or the means of producing stone tools, and lithic typology, the kinds of stone tools that were made, and how these change through time. As you walk, if you walk around the deserts of Jordan, you will notice a large expanse sometimes of nothing but flint as far as the eye can see. Now, flint is formed at the bottoms of oceans, to give you a clue about the past environments of Jordan. Jordan at one time was the bottom of a very large ocean approximately 200 million years ago, called the Tethys Sea. While the sea covered Jordan, Palestine, Syria, Saudi Arabia, huge, thick layers of flint were formed. Now, I'm not sure exactly how flint forms. It is a sedimentary process. That is, little things fall down through the water, accumulate on the base, and then through heat and pressure, this material is converted into a very glassy-like substance. Now, normally it will form in layers, but not all the time. Sometimes it will form, as Aziza said earlier tonight, almost like fossil coconuts. Now, usually the insides of these fossil coconuts will be also filled with flint, but occasionally you find some hollow ones that develop. In the eastern deserts of Jordan, most of the flint you see, therefore, will be natural flint, untouched by Homo sapiens or his earlier ancestors, and they can provide a bewildering array of forms that can, to the untrained eye, be confused with stone tools. Hopefully, after this course, you'll be able to go out there, kink your eye at a flint and say, natural, or hand axe, or end string. Okay? Flint is a very useful kind of resource in the sense that it is a homogeneous material. Very much like the glass you see in windows, flint is a crystalline structure which has a very regular and even series of planes where the molecules line up not only across but also down. Now, it's not necessarily cubic like I'm drawing it here. It could be hexagonal. It could be you have solid insides that have 24 sides to a small piece of this flint. But the main thing is that if you strike the flint, it will follow one of those planes, which means that you can more or less predict what's going to happen when you make a stone tool. Other kinds of stone, such as granite, sandstone, feldspar, are actually not homogeneous. They usually have big, clunky pieces in the middle of this crystalline lattice or this crystalline structure. And when you strike it, the force could blow anywhere, and you can't really predict what kind of an edge you're going to get. Now, the entire reason for making stone tools is to make an edge. You want a sharp edge, you want an edge of a particular shape. So it's easier to get those edges if you can predict, more or less, what's going to happen as a result of the force you apply to it. Anything that is not homogeneous, you might as well just use the stone as you found it to begin with. You might produce a nice sharp edge, but you might also be 85 years old before you find it. Now, before the onset of stone tool manufacture, those ancestors of human beings who realized somehow that nature provided sharp edges or edges of particular shapes could have used natural flint for anything they wanted to do. Again, if you've been driving through the desert and perhaps you get a puncture in your tires, you can readily appreciate that natural flint does have a lot of sharp edges. In this instance, that is, if we're talking about 3 million years ago, for example, the use of sharp edges is very difficult to determine. If you go out to the deserts again today, when you see these vast flint fields, there are a lot of sharp edges, but in order to try and pick out human workmanship or human use of natural sharp edges, it would take almost superhuman effort to locate these things. On the other hand, when the ancestors of mankind began to shape his own tools, there are some characteristics that are very easy to spot, and we can distinguish these, at least, these stone tools, from naturally sharp material that may have been used but not altered by man or his earlier ancestors. This will indicate a natural stone. Nothing in stone tools that are round, but we'll just say this is a natural stone. The flint, as it occurs naturally, normally has a skin on the outside. Very rough, usually, it kind of looks almost like sandpaper. Very easily seen. And that skin is called the cortex. Cortex is generally very thin. Here you can see it's not more, it's less than a millimeter thick. You may, if you're a stone tool maker, want or you may not want cortex to be on your stone tool. If you don't want it to be on the stone tool, you try to remove it, and it's very easily removed, as I'll show you a little bit later in a demonstration. Striking the stone on the edge, you start to remove chips. Now, of course, this rock could have fallen down and shattered the little chips coming off, but there are, as I said before, these very good indicators that will distinguish between natural chips and man-made chips. One of the inside of the flake, that is the flake that used to be facing towards the center of the stone, is called the interior surface, and that is our best indicator. The interior surface very often will be smooth, almost flat, with slight undulations. I have to pardon some of my artwork because I did not take any classes in art appreciation. But now we are looking at the interior surface. At the top of the interior surface, there will be generally a flat plane, and this is called the striking platform. Near the center of the striking platform, usually, there will be a slight bulge, a slight prominence. This is the exact point a person struck that stone before the flake came off. This is called the point of percussion. Just kind of sneak that in. Okay, the point of percussion, the point where it is actually struck. Emanating from that point of percussion will be a bulge, a bulb. It happens almost only when a flake is produced by a human being. It's a slight bulge sticking out of the otherwise flat surface. See it here in profile. Now, if you can't see things very well from where you are right now, we've got plenty of examples up here. But this is called the bulb of percussion. That almost never forms naturally. I say almost never. In nature, anything can happen. So you might find out of 1,000 flakes, 1,000 natural flakes, you might find two or three that would have a bulb of percussion. But the other 99.9% would not. They would not have that bulge at the end. Remember, it's at one end of the flake. And then, as the flake comes off, in small concentric arcs, you have a series of ripples that are very easily seen on large flakes. Now, small flakes, all of these things become very minute, so it can be difficult to distinguish. But these ripples again, are very rare in natural flakes. Natural flakes that occur if a rock falls on top of another rock usually produce only a flat plane, and the bulk of percussion and the ripples do not exist. If you looked at this flake edge on now, it would look sort of like this, with the bulk of percussion at one end and a series of ripples on the other end. Now, of course, now it should be very easy for you. I pass this thing around now. Start seeing these things. It should be very easy to recognize these flakes in contrast to natural flakes, because these things simply don't occur very often. Of course, we have one problem. What if, in order to make their stone tool, they wanted to change the shape of this flake now, and they said they knocked that part off? Then you have some more difficulty facing you, because these, the striking platform, point percussion, and the bulb of percussion are the most useful factors to distinguish natural flakes from man-made flakes. If that part is broken off the flake and you're left with only the distal end, the far end of the flake down here, then you have to probably toss a coin. It's very difficult to tell these things unless you've got a lot of experience in working with broken man-made flakes. But at the site now, at Angazal, for example, most of the flakes we see that have not been converted into tools will certainly have those three factors, and you should be able to determine whether or not it's a lump or a natural flake and throw it away, or whether or not it's man-made and keep it. If you have any question, don't throw it away. I'll just throw it in the back. Now, this, in the general term, this is called the flake. Anything that comes off another stone, something that's smaller, something that is struck off a stone, is called the flake. That is a general category. We'll go into more specifics in a little bit. The stone from which the flake came is called the core. Okay, so we already have a dichotomy of artifacts then. We have the flakes and cores from which the flakes came. Now, since the object of making stone tools is to use them as tools, we can have then core tools or flake tools. In core tools, you remove flakes in order to get the proper edge. In flake tools, you produce flakes. You use the flakes that you make to get the proper edge. As the flakes come off a core, they will have sharp edges, almost always. But as I said before, it's not just the sharpness, it's not the edge angle that you may be interested in. It may be the shape of the edge as you look at it from the top. In this case, you may want to change the shape of this flake. If we looked at that flake, looked at that flake from the top, like this, all this entire edge may be very sharp, but maybe you don't want those undulations, those things sticking out. You can change the shape of the edge then by a process called retouch. Changing the shape of the edge using a term called retouch. Now, retouch will change not only the shape, it will also alter the edge angle. A very sharp edge is also a very fragile edge. And if you use it, you can make it dull very quickly. You can resharpen it and change the edge angle also with the process of retouch. So you can change the shape and the edge angle with this thing called retouch. As you knock flakes off a core,
say that we've knocked two flakes off this core now. The rest of it still has the skin or the cortex left on it. That bulb percussion and those ripples will leave a negative impression on the stone. So you will have a negative bulb of percussion left on the core, and very often you will have negative ripples near the end. We have a good example of that. Didn't I bring it? We have a good example of that. We have a lot of good examples of that here.
Oh, yeah.
Here again, if you look at the edge of this core, a big flake is taken out here. Look, there's a huge hole right there, the negative bulb of percussion. And near the end, you hold it up to the light, you can see the ripple. Now, as I take more and more flakes off this core, so I knock another one off here, I'm going to be altering all of this stuff. I'm going to get a whole bunch of confusing lines. Move another one here. What I'm doing unintentionally is creating a series of facets. Okay? Each removal of a flake from the core produces a facet on that core, a place where a flake used to be. Now, each flake that I remove subsequent to this, now let's say that I strike another flake off here, the exterior of that core is going to be on the surface of the flake I removed. Let's say I just removed this flake now from here. I'm going to get a series of intersecting facets from earlier flakes that were removed. Does that make sense? Okay. So on the exterior surface, I will have facets that have negative bulbs and negative ripples. At least negative ripples, not necessarily negative bulbs. I might have a negative bulb here, but if I intersect a place here where there were no other negative bulbs to begin with, they will not show up here. But here's another clue then for distinguishing man-made flakes from natural flakes. The interior surface will have that bulb of percussion, point of percussion, striking platform. The exterior surface normally will have negative ripples on facets. Okay. It could also have an area where previously flakes had not been removed from the core and were left with some cortex remaining. That may be something very important. This large core that's coming around now. In fact, the people who detached the flakes obviously wanted only flakes with cortex on it. They didn't want flakes with facets. We don't know why. Maybe it was easier for them to hold than they were using. But they left a good half a kilogram of perfectly good flint lying behind after they removed three or four flakes. So the exterior surface can also, spell it right, Gary, you're a graduate. The exterior surface will have these facets with the negative ripples. Sometimes it's hard to see the negative ripples unless you hold it up to the light and let the light bounce off just right. We'll be talking a little bit later about different techniques of producing these things. And as the techniques become more advanced, the clues to distinguish them from natural flakes become more and more difficult to determine, to discern. Now, just to show you how easy it is to make stone tools. Oh, by the way, this is a natural flake. It has facets on it, but it has no negative ripples. Okay, this is the way it was just formed. It's been lying out in the sun. The sun heats the flint up, and the outside heats up faster than the inside, and expands, and finally it just pops off. Sometimes it pops off with a loud noise as well. You wake up at night. Yeah, that's another thing. During the day, the flint heats up. At night, it cools off. And again, the outside cools off faster than the inside. And if you're sleeping out in the desert, you might occasionally hear a pow thing as one of these things goes
sliding past your ear. Perhaps you'll remember that next time you camp out on a flint field. But this is a natural piece. It has nothing to do with mankind. Now, if you're going to produce flakes or change the shape of flakes, you can only do it by striking the edge. You cannot change the shape of a flake by striking it from the center. Okay? So all of these ripples here have to go towards, have to go from one edge to the other. It can't start in the middle of the flake. And, well, I'm going to turn my back with a little wizardry here. I just don't want you people to get showered with. There, very good example, man-made flake. You see all the things I'm talking about, except perhaps the ripples. No, there are ripples. Made the rough out of a crude hand axe. This is something that was made as early as 1.5 million years ago and lasted until maybe 60,000 years ago. But it's a crude example. In the show, what was that? It was 1 minute. I was able to produce a very jagged cutting edge here. It's not a very good example, actually. But anyway, it's very easy to do, and with a little practice, you can get very, very good at it. And in fact, there are some people who devote their lives to, or not their lives, but at least their free time, who can do things just as well, if not better, than some of the people who had to rely on stone technology. I started that for a particular reason, and I lost my train of thought. Yeah. Well, I think we can leave it at that. I mean, when you change the shape of something, you start from the edge and work towards the center of the material. Now, I said before that the flakes, material that come off the core, is a general category. We have special kinds of flakes. So we could have another dichotomy under that first dichotomy. Two major kinds of flakes that are produced, you can produce, are called either flakes, again, or blades. Now, as the name blade implies, it's a long, narrow flake with roughly parallel edges, and generally is twice as long as it is wide. Okay? But that does not mean that any flake you pick up that is twice as long as it is wide is a blade. Let me show you why. All right. Now we're getting into the area of interpretation or prejudice. Let's say that on this core we had removed a series of flakes, more or less directed towards the center, maybe not. And by accident, we strike another flake off, and the flake comes off. Flake that comes off is long, twice as long as it is wide or more. The sides are roughly parallel, not exactly, but it's the way the flint chips sometimes. But on the outside of that flake, from those other facets, you will have evidence that it is, in fact, an accidentally long flake. compared to, for example, a core from which we have always struck the same kind of flake. The next one that comes off, right here, will have facets on the exterior surface that are parallel to the edges. This is the true blade. This is simply a long flake, elongated flake. The blade has, on its exterior surface, evidence of previous blades having been removed. This is an actual object, objective of the technology, not an accident that happened just because certain forces worked out to produce something that was long and roughly parallel. Now, the reason I make this distinction is that in the development of, or in the changes of stone tool technology, blades become extremely important with the appearance of modern Homo sapiens, that is, people just like us. After the Neanderthals leave the scene, or the Neanderthaloids leave the scene, the blade, this kind of blade, becomes extremely important for everybody who is still making stone tools. If you call any long flake a blade, this can confuse the analysis, or somebody who's reading the results of an analysis. You might find that we had Homo erectus, or Peking man, a long time ago, making tremendous numbers of, quote, blades, unquote. Yet that is completely different than this in terms of the concept in the mind before it's removed, and in fact what you could do to that blade once it was produced. All of these facets, if I wanted to change the shape of these edges, all those facets are going to control the force I put on it. So if I wanted to retouch the edge of this thing, it's going to take me a lot more time and effort than if I wanted to retouch this, simply because those facets are going to interfere with the lines of force as I apply it, either by percussion or knocking on the edges, or by pressure, by pushing off different parts of that edge. Now, the oldest stone tools for which we have a fairly reliable date go back to about 2.3 to 2.5 million years. Now, this was in Africa, Eastern Africa, in Ethiopia, in the Hadar region of Ethiopia. In the future, I will talk about dating techniques, at least two of them that are very important. But for now, perhaps you just take it on word of faith that we can date things 2.5 million years and more. In fact, we can push it back to billions of years. But of course, there were no human beings around or direct ancestors at that time. The tools that were made from 2.5 billion years to 2.5 million years, sorry, to approximately a half a million years ago relied on one technique alone. And this is called the hard hammer technique. And this is simply using one stone in one hand to bash against another stone. Okay, the hard hammer here refers to a stone. Stone hammer, or in fact, it's called a hammer stone, all right? Now, the use of the hard hammer technique also has some characteristics that distinguish it from other kinds of techniques that we'll cover a little bit later. First of all, going back to that interior surface of the flake, the point of percussion will be very large, generally. Okay. In fact, that one flake that's going around now is probably hard hammer technique because there's a very large platform. And associated with that large platform is a large bulb of percussion. we look at the edge of the flake, very often that bulb of percussion will take up half the thickness of the flake itself. It's struck here from hard hammer technique. The ripples are also more pronounced. And on the back, on the exterior surface, the facets, the negative scars, or the facets on the exterior surface will normally be deeper and with pronounced negative ripples. So for almost 2 million years, this was the sole technique of producing stone tools. There's a variation on the hard hammer technique called the anvil technique. And this is simply picking up your core with both hands and swinging it against another large stone. So you knock flakes off in that direction. Hopefully you knock flakes off in that direction. If it's not too difficult, in fact, to knock those things straight up into your face again, I don't try the anvil technique. My face may be rugged and only my mother loves it, but I have no reason to change the shape of it with the anvil technique. It's been claimed that the anvil technique was a very prominent technique used in Europe, especially in England and in Northern Europe. I'm not certain. I cannot distinguish the differences in any of these factors between the anvil technique and the normal hard hammer.
You hold it.
Yeah, you hold it. Yeah, if you throw the stone, it's going to be the same thing as a stone striking another stone. And you won't get man-made flakes, you just get natural flakes. This is not to say they don't